I'm ready to go back. I'm ready to go back.
It's just nice to see their eyes light up when they walk
in. She was just excited to get ready and see everybody that she's met.
The stuff that they were like doing, I'm like, oh shoot. Trying to teach fractions, like, you know how hard that is?
I'm glad that they had this opportunity to see each other before the summer.
Students, parents, and teachers from around California as in-person instruction resumed in many districts. But even as kids head back to the classroom, California public schools saw their biggest enrollment decline in two decades. 160,000 fewer students in the school year, according to data out yesterday from the State Department of Education. The biggest drop came in kindergarten. The pandemic is the primary reason, of course, but there are also other factors. We're going to talk about this now with Karen D'Souza. She covers early education for EdSource, and she's been looking into this. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So 160,000 students, that's about a 3% decline. Huge number. What do you make of that?
It's a big drop. Frankly, everyone in the early education community was expecting some kind of drop because of the nature of kindergarten. Five-year-olds are at such a vulnerable age, and you know, interacting with the computer is not exactly their native medium. So we knew a lot of those kids weren't going to participate in K, or were anticipating that. But I don't think anyone would have predicted it to be quite this huge a number. 61,000 children is a big number.
So 61,000 kindergartners, and the rest are in which grades?
Really spread out all throughout, although I would say, I mean, the biggest group is kindergarten. There was also a large cluster in sixth grade and ninth grade.
And why those grades in particular? Because they're transitional grades?
Exactly. That is the theory, that those are inflection points in the child's educational journey anyway. There are times when parents might have already decided to switch to a private school or a bigger school. There's sort of points where it's easier to make a change.
Okay. And as we're, it's probably all or most of it is pandemic related, right? At least with the younger kids, it makes sense that parents wouldn't want to put them in a Zoom kindergarten. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, I know. So I have a 10-year-old, and Zoom school is pretty hard on her. I can't imagine a five-year-old spending hours day in front of a screen. But definitely the pandemic triggered this, but there were some pre-existing factors already. There was already an incidence of declining enrollment, which is related to a lot of things, from declining birth rate to, you know, we've had a lot of families leave the state. There's definitely been an exodus from California. So some of that was in play before the pandemic.
I see. Well, so what is the effect if you miss kindergarten? A lot of people think, well, that's probably not such a big deal because mainly you are listening to stories and playing and it's not a lot of rigorous instruction when you're 5 years
Indeed.
Old. So can kids afford to lose that year?
Right. A lot of people remember kindergarten as like finger painting and nap time. But I think actually all the instruction, kindergarten and first grade in particular, has gotten more academically rigorous. Now, kindergarten is not mandatory in the state of California, but a lot of the research suggests that if you lose out on that early education, it can really set the course for the rest of your time in school. Specifically, people from low-income families, those children tend to be at a real disadvantage.
And so
a lot
when
of the
achievement
gap that we worry about actually is, you know, it's there before the child starts school.
Oh, wow. And so let's say they skip or they didn't attend kindergarten and they go to first grade in the fall. Would they be significantly behind their peers in first grade?
That is the real worry. I mean, specifically for and it is, again, it's sort of all who you are. Now, the interesting thing about the state numbers for kindergarten, 61,000 is a big number, but that number actually folds in children who would have been in transitional kindergarten. Now, the good news there is those TK kids will just move on to into K in the fall. So whatever, you know, learning loss may be at play can be really mitigated. It's the K kids, as you say, who have to go into first grade that we worry about. First grade is a lot more academically rigorous than it used to be.
Right. And so are districts preparing for that? Are they adjusting their curricula?
It's certainly been a topic of discussion, you know, whether or not we need to really look at curriculum, whether or not some of the benchmarks need to be shifted given what's happened. There's also a lot of districts who are trying to look at summer school and tutoring and other ways to kind of catch kids up before the fall. Of course, we still don't know exactly what instruction will look like in the fall.
And how many of these kids are lost to the public school systems entirely? Let's say their parents thought, okay, we're just going to bite the bullet and send the kids to private school, and that'll be it for public school.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a pretty big number. There were about 20,000 new private school affidavits filed last year, although a significant percentage of that is also homeschooling. So some parents chose to go to private schools. Private schools and charter schools were both more likely to go back to in-person instruction, which really, you know, speaks to what kindergartners need. They need that live and in-person interaction. Other parents actually chose to keep the child in preschool, since many kids were already in a learning environment that was safe and familiar and interactive and in person. And then, of course, the move to homeschool. Some parents who were juggling toddlers or children and jobs thought it was easier just to sort of do the homeschooling themselves on their own schedule than having to do your job and sort of also monitor a day of school on Zoom.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine that once school is back for real, that those parents would send their kids back to school, or most of them would, and not continue homeschooling.
That is the hope. Although, you know, there are people who believe in homeschool who will say that, you know, they've discovered, you know, a lot of times your child can move at their own pace if you can homeschool. I mean, if you have the resources to make that work. But I believe the belief is most of the districts think the kids will come back in first grade.
Is this now, of course, a funding? Is this a problem for funding?
Indeed. Now, it's not going to be a problem right now or even in the near future, because districts can choose to use their current numbers or their previous year numbers. But looking ahead to 22-23, if the kids don't come back in significant numbers, then there might be some funding issues.
Right. And I don't know if you've been looking into this at all, but I'm wondering if there has been any fallout in terms of support for teachers' unions during this whole pandemic. A lot of parents frustrated that they couldn't send their kids back to school for in-person instruction because teachers' unions said that they would have to be vaccinated. The teachers would have to be vaccinated first. And so I don't know, looking forward, what that's going to mean in terms of support for unions and support for public schools in general.
I think that's a big issue. I think, interestingly, the pandemic has sort of intensified a lot of pre-existing tensions between different parts of society, and that's a really excellent example of it. The question of, you know, how well do we fund our public schools? Are the teachers happy? Are the families getting what they want out of public school? I think all of those discussions are going to be a lot more intense going forward because of this experience.
Karen D'Souza from EdSource, thank you.
Thank you.
UC and Cal State systems say they plan to require students and faculty to get a COVID vaccine before returning to campus this fall. It's the largest such mandate in higher education, and it covers more than a million people. There's a catch, though. The mandate from the two university systems will only come after the FDA formally approves the vaccines and there is sufficient supply. Right now, all the vaccines have been approved on an emergency use basis. We're going to get into some of the legal questions surrounding vaccination now with Dorit Rice. She's a professor of law at UC Hastings. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's first talk about the UC and Cal State systems. And they have this mandate, but as I mentioned, there are these caveats. That's part of the law when it comes to emergency use authorization. So how do you expect this to play out?
So the first question is timing. We don't know exactly when the FDA will move to approve the vaccines. Pfizer said it will apply for full approval by the end of this month. But historically, the FDA took about 12 months to approve vaccines. I expect them to move faster, but it will still be a matter of months. And I don't know if they will complete it before the fall.
Right. And some classes begin in August, right?
Yes. Semester begins in August.
So that could open the possibility that they won't have the authorization in place by the first day of classes. So would students be allowed to attend even if they weren't vaccinated?
Under the current policy, that's what the university is planning. As long as a vaccine is not yet fully approved, students do not have to get it before attending classes.
Can government institutions in general mandate vaccines? If you receive public money from the government, can you require vaccination?
Government institutions vary in this, and specifically to university, the answer is yes. We have a long history of public and private universities requiring vaccine. It's usually by the institution, not by the state, although states have sometimes required vaccines from all university students in the state. But for example, the University of California has been requiring vaccines since 2015. Students attending the university have to get 4 vaccines since 2015, and the only exception is a medical exception.
Hmm. So it would be no different, I guess, with the COVID vaccine, legally.
Yes, they're planning to address it under similar rules. There is a difference, and that's probably because they are ending in staff. They're going to offer religious exemption from the COVID-19 vaccine, which isn't the case from the existing vaccines. Unlike students, employees can be required to vaccinate as well, but they have to be provided with accommodation if they have a sincere religious objection, unless it's a high burden for the employer. So the university, since it's requiring vaccines from the employees, is providing a religious exemption. And I think the logic of applying it to students is not to distinguish between these categories. If employees get a religious exemption, so do students.
In general, what is happening with private employment and the vaccines? Can private employers require that their employees get vaccinated?
Historically, private employers can require vaccines. And for example, many healthcare facilities have required influenza vaccines and other vaccines. Restaurants have required hepatitis A vaccines. The trick with these vaccines is that there's legal uncertainty whether you can require a vaccine under an EUA. And there's no court decision on this because a EUA vaccine for the whole population is a new thing. So we don't have any judicial guidance, and the law itself is not quite clear. But the University of California will only require it once the vaccines are approved, so they're avoiding this issue.
Hmm. Right. And so there are lawsuits, right, that have already been filed on this issue, and I believe one is located here in Los Angeles, a group that includes teachers, is suing the Los Angeles Unified School District over a requirement that that its employees be vaccinated, and basically saying that when it's under emergency use authorization, it's basically clinical research, and you cannot perform research on human subjects without the informed consent of the person receiving the treatment. That's their claim. Is that the reason why you can object to getting the vaccine if it's only under emergency use authorization?
Even if in the first few days the vaccines were still just out of a clinical trial, the vaccines not only have undergone clinical trial in tens of thousands of people, as large or larger than approved vaccines, they have since been given to tens of millions of people. Saying that vaccines that were safely given to tens of millions of people are still in research is stretching the term really extremely. It doesn't work.
Hmm. Is it legal for employers to ask their employees if they've been vaccinated?
What you're raising is, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, there's a limit to how much you can ask someone about their medical status. And the risk with that question is that it might push an employee to disclosing a disability. But just asking whether you're vaccinated doesn't touch on that. People can be not vaccinated for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with disabilities. So employers can ask, did you get vaccinated? But if they want to go ahead after that and ask, do you have a medical reason not to vaccinate? They have to follow the rules set under the Americans with Disabilities Act to protect privacy and to limit that information to the appropriate people in the organization.
And is it legal for businesses to require a vaccine for customers?
Yes. So private businesses traditionally have a lot of leeway to set conditions for people to come in. No shoes, no shirt, no service. You can extend this to no vaccine or service. It's their business. It's their a private area and they can set the rules.
So what do you anticipate happening legally? As I mentioned, a few lawsuits have already been filed. How do you anticipate this to be played out in the courts?
When the University of California required a flu vaccine last fall, there was a lawsuit led by an anti-vaccine organization, the Children's Health Defense, and I expect we'll see more. I also expect most of those lawsuits to lose, as the lawsuit against the flu vaccine requirement lost.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dorit Rice. She's a professor of law at UC Hastings. Coming up, are shipping containers a solution for housing the homeless? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles is in desperate need of solutions to solve its homelessness crisis. More than 66,000 people in the county live on the streets, in their cars, or in shelters. One idea to house them quickly is to build temporary shelters out of tiny prefab homes and shipping containers. And that is being done in a couple spots here in LA. But are these homes humane? Does living in a shipping container feel like living in a shipping container? Those are some of the questions LA Times arts and architecture columnist Carolina Miranda wanted to answer in a recent story, and she joins us now to talk about it. Hi.
Hello.
Well, yeah, it does sound like you are putting human beings in places where they don't belong when you're talking about shipping containers, but they have been around for a while in the architecture world, in the housing world, in the prefab housing world, and you went to tour some recently. How do they feel being inside them?
You know, that was a question I was asking myself, because these have been around in various forms. And I think, you know, in the case of tiny homes, we've all seen those like quaint, you know, architecture magazine, super adorable tiny homes and great, beautifully landscaped backyards. But my question was, what do the shipping container homes and the tiny houses that LA is using to house the unhoused, what do those look like and feel like? And I have to say, I was pretty impressed with the designs. I think with the tiny homes, one of my big concerns going into it was issues of climate control and ventilation and light. And the units that the city is using by this company called Pallet out of Washington State are really smartly designed. They have a separate fire exit. They have four windows for cross ventilation. They have independently controlled ventilation systems, so you can heat and ventilate your unit, so that way it doesn't feel like an oven in summer and an icebox in winter. And same with the shipping container units. You know, a shipping container unit is really just a structure, and once you put in the drywall and all of the other sort of furniture elements, it looks just like any other apartment.
And you can put in ventilation and windows and the whole shebang.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the shipping container apartments I visited, the project in downtown, the Hilda Solis project, and also a South LA project for Clifford Beers Housing. The architects, I think, had really sort of taken a lot of time to think about how they could make it feel less like a shipping container. So choosing the tallest range of shipping containers, cutting floor to ceiling windows in them to maximize light and ventilation, really trying to think about how do you make these spaces habitable and humane and make them a place that people want to be in, and that will really offer shelter when somebody is coming off the street, and not something that feels, you know, desperate or terrible.
So those two that you mentioned, the one in downtown and South LA, how many people could conceivably live there?
The downtown project is the much bigger project, and that is an interim housing project. So that is temporary housing, and it's a total of 232 people in a mix of shipping container apartments, and then they also have some portable units, like the types of portables used for classrooms or construction trailers. And then the South LA development, that is permanent supportive housing. And that's something like 54 one-bedroom apartments that sleep up to two people. Once they land there, they're there and they can stay there as long as they want to or need to. It comes with all kinds of services as well in terms of providing social support, economic support in securing everything from like IDs, finding work, training, all of those things.
And is that our HHH money, our bond dollars at work right there?
Yes. Yes. These projects all in some form use HHH money. You know, there's also private philanthropy that goes into it. One of the things that the architects realized when they were building that development, it's on a very awkward sort of triangular shaped piece of land right off of Imperial Highway. And there's a little road that runs next to it. And they were like, you know, if we can turn this road into a pedestrian park, this development will just be a much nicer place to be and will provide a neighborhood that desperately needs green space a little bit of green space. So they were able to work with the city to turn that into a green space, and the Annenberg Foundation kicked in $2.5 million to make the construction on that happen.
Oh, wow. And then you also toured another community in North Hollywood, the Chandler Street Tiny Home Village. Tell us about that one.
Those are the basic tiny home units. It's one to two people per unit. And if you are alone, you don't share it. The idea is that these are private spaces with a lock and key so that you can come in and have your own space. But if you're a couple, it also means you can share a space. Or if you're with a family member, you can share a space. I think one of the challenges of the shelter system is that often it splits up families up. You know, men have to go one place, women have to go another, parents and children are separated. And so the idea behind these is how can we, you know, begin to help keep people together. There is a meal services brought in by the providing partners, and there are bathrooms and laundry facilities on site, as well as storage, and interestingly, a dog run, because one of the things that has been a hindrance to getting people to come into the shelter system and seek services is requiring them to split from a beloved pet. And so now those types of facilities are built into these villages so people can bring a beloved pet with them.
And how big are these homes?
These homes are tiny. They're 64 square feet.
Mm. So 8x8, basically. That's 64 square feet.
Sound. It's a room.
It's small.
It's a little cabin. It's like cabin size.
Did it feel like that?
I was expecting them to feel rather suffocating. They are designed high enough and the pitched roof gives them enough headspace so that they don't feel that way. And then I think the window design also helps a lot. They have four windows, two on the front and two on the back. So you can open them all, you get daylight, you get air. But really, this is the most basic form of shelter. And while I think it's important to have like a whole palette of solutions to deal with the housing crisis, and this is one of them, we certainly should not begin to think of it as a permanent one.
Mm, yeah. What do the residents think, the people living there? Do they like it?
You know, I spoke to a number of people and they liked it and they were happy with that as an interim housing option, as opposed to a shelter in a dormitory style shelter in which they'd have to be sharing space with others. One woman I spoke with who had been living in her car and then in a park, she told me what she appreciated was being able to have her own space with a lock and a key, you know, that felt secure. You know, and another gentleman I spoke with, it was the same thing, feeling that there was a place that he could put his belongings and his things and that he, you know, nobody else would have access to that. That was very important. Nobody suggested any major design changes to them, which I found surprising. I mean, I'm always thinking about how you can make something better. You know, if I were to think about those spaces, I would think a little bit more about what kinds of shade structures you can build in addition to the tiny houses, because, you know, some of these places are in the valley and it gets hot.
Yeah. And the million-dollar question is, how much money are these things costing? Is it expensive to build this housing?
It's expensive and cheap at the same time. The tiny houses are a few thousand dollars. What costs money, and I think the stories that we've seen about the costs related to this have a lot to do with dealing with the site before you can put tiny houses on them. So building foundations, making the spaces ADA compliant, building walkways, again, that are ADA compliant or fire department compliant, bringing in sewage and water and electricity. Some of these sites, like, for example, the Chandler Tiny Home Village does not have a sewage line. They had to run a line out to the street. That's where a lot of the money ultimately goes, is just prepping the sites.
Well, this idea of tiny homes, it's not a new idea at all, either for, you know, people who are unhoused or not. Why now? Why are we seeing all these developments come about now?
I think tiny homes are not new, and other cities like Seattle and Austin are doing them and have been doing them. I think the reason we're seeing them now is the city is being much more flexible about building codes. One of the reasons it takes so long to build housing, any sort of housing in Los Angeles, is codes, whether it's seismic or sewer or electrical. And that has been a holdup on trying to do projects quickly. But over the last few years, I think there's been a revisiting of those ideas, like, okay, let's begin to think about the temporary solution, and can we loosen the codes for the temporary solutions, and then the permanent solutions will be something else. And so you're now beginning to see types of design, tiny homes, shipping containers, that in the past would have been almost impossible to permit through the Department of Buildings.
Oh, interesting. Carolina Miranda, columnist for the LA Times, covering arts and architecture. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews.
And if you like really tough guy stuff, and you like heads exploding and people saying like mean stuff to each other, I guess you'll get through it, but it's not very good.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. The Oscars are this weekend, but if you've already seen all the nominations, there are some new films for you to enjoy this weekend. Joining us for some reviews is William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and the critically acclaimed Network. Welcome back.
It is so good to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's so good to have you. And Katie Walsh, she reviews films for the Tribune News Service and for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Madeline.
Let's begin with a film from a franchise I'm sure a lot of people in listener land are already familiar with, whether it's from video games or movies from the 90s. It's the new Mortal Kombat movie. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Throughout history, different cultures all over the world reference a great tournament. That dragon marking? I think it's an invitation to fight for something known as Mortal Kombat.
These are your champions.
I'm Sonya. That's Kano.
I'm Liu Kang.
Name's Jax.
Kung Lao.
The fate of Earth is in our hands.
All right, Bibbs. Is this, what is this? Remake? Sequel?
It's a reboot.
What is
it's based on a fighting game about a bunch of people who are fighting for the fate of the world. Earthlings who have dragon birthmarks, and that means they're chosen to fight a bunch of like freeze ninjas and dragon people and like a cyborg. And if it sounds like I am describing this in somewhat immature terms, it's because it's a very immature movie. It's a fight movie where the fights range from pretty cool to and it's an action movie where the characters are really broadly drawn, very naively presented. The plot ranges from way too simple to unnecessarily complex, and it's basically just a whole lot of mediocrity just thrown onto the screen. And if you like really tough guy stuff, and you like heads exploding and people saying like mean stuff to each other, I guess you'll get through it, but it's not very good.
Okay, a whole lot of mediocrity. Katie, would you agree?
You know, I guess I do like tough guy stuff and heads exploding, because I had fun with this movie. It made me feel like a kid again. I was like, yes, I want to see the digital blood spurting everywhere. I'm back in the arcade hammering those sticky buttons. I had fun with this. I mean, it's like cool fights and bad acting. Like, what more do you want? That's like kind of part of the charm. It's definitely obviously better than the first 1995 film directed by Paul W.S. Anderson. But obviously, we all have a lot of nostalgia for that 1995 film. And, you know, this is a film for it's not for kids. It's for the people who were kids when the first movie came out. And those people are pushing 40 now. So it's definitely violent. It's definitely, you know, and the film, the game itself was very violent. And that was like its whole thing when it came out, was that it was, you know, super bloody. And so it you know, pays tribute to that in the film. But I had fun with it. I mean, I definitely just like sort of was swept away by, you know, kind of its silly charms. And I enjoyed a lot of the fight choreography and the people who were in the film. I mean, they have some great martial artists and actors who've been in films like The Raid, Redemption, and Hiroyuki Sanada is in it, and he's this legendary Japanese actor. So I had fun with it.
Okay.
I wish I had as much fun with it as I had in the original film. I feel like the original film had a little bit more awareness of how kind of ridiculous the whole premise was. And in this film, every time they said in like really gruff tones what the plot was, it felt like everyone was fighting off like a giggle. I feel like it just took itself too seriously to truly be enjoyable, and I wasn't that big a fan of the original 1995 one even when I was a kid, so maybe that's the problem.
All right, moving on to Together Together. This stars Ed Helms as a single man who's decided he is ready to have a child by himself with a surrogate who is played by Patty Harrison. The two end up spending a lot of time together. Here's a clip.
Mom, Dad, have some exciting news. I'm pregnant. I mean, the surrogate is pregnant.
Why are you doing this alone?
Because I am alone. Why are you alone?
I don't think being alone is a bad thing.
Is that what this is like donating an organ?
I don't know. I've never donated an organ before.
Okay, this sounds heartwarming and a little predictable looking at the trailer. Katie?
Yeah, I liked this film a lot. It's a indie comedy that played at Sundance. It's written and directed by Nicole Beckwith. And in many ways, it is predictable. But it's really a film that sort of touches on what it means to be alone and what it looks like to be alone. And is that okay? And what I think is radical about it is that it doesn't condemn being alone. You know, you expect these little comedies to kind of always be like, these people end up together and, you know, there's a romance. And it's like, no, this is just sort of a platonic love story about going after the things you want, whether or not you are with someone or not, and finding the connections along the way and like enjoying the connections along the way. And Patty Harrison is known for her sort of weird comedy that she does. She plays the very rude assistant to John Cameron Mitchell on Hulu's Shrill, and she's super funny. And in this, she's in a much different tone, and I just think she's a wonderful, luminous leading lady. It was a nice movie.
Bibbs?
Yeah, I was actually a little surprised by how dry this movie is. You know, Ed Helms has a tendency to gravitate towards slightly broader material than this, and this is just two people connecting with each other in an unusual circumstance, and they both bring wonderful work to the table. Ed Helms, I think, is better than I think I've seen him maybe ever. Patty Harrison is incredible. I wasn't incredibly familiar with her TV work, so this was a bit of a revelation for me. And yeah, I appreciated that this didn't go down the usual rom-com material. However, I do think that there is an interesting sort of subtle detail at the very end of the movie that kind of recontextualizes it and makes it a little bit more incisive and cynical than I think some people are giving it credit for. But I also think that if you ignore that or if you miss it, it's just perfectly charming.
Okay, moving on to Stowaway, in which a three-person mission to Mars winds up with an extra passenger.
Do you remember what happened on the pad?
I'm a launch support engineer, ma'am. How long was I out?
We took off about 12 hours ago.
12 hours? I need to get back to my sister, please. My sister, she's alone. Please, I gotta get back.
We're not going back.
What do you mean we're not going back? This is a two-year mission.
We only have enough oxygen board for three people.
Everyone on board will suffocate before we ever make it to Mars.
Katie, not enough oxygen. There's only enough for three, and yet there are four. So what happens?
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
it's kind of all right there in the trailer, you know, the question that this film asks. And, you know, that's what's kind of interesting about sci-fi and genre is that it can put human beings in these abnormal situations, and then these ethical questions can play out in a very high stakes way. Anna Kendrick is basically the star of this film. She is a doctor who has applied to go to Mars and do research along with Daniel Dae Kim, and Toni Collette plays the commander who's taking them. This is directed by Joe Penna, who made his directorial debut with the wilderness survival thriller Arctic, starring Mads Mikkelsen. And this is a really pretty good, follow-up. It's like a very slick, beautifully made sci-fi film. I really enjoyed the pace. It's like a very controlled pace. I do, you know, after a while, though, it's like a little bit too controlled. Like, you want that moment where it sort of breaks free of this, you know, very kind of like tightly controlled situation that they're in, and it never quite breaks free. I will say that I was totally on board with this movie until the very end, and then the ending completely ruined it for me. And I won't say what it is, but I can't like this movie anymore. I just
well
was
now
like,
you're
no.
making me intrigued, because now I want to see what the ending is. Because the rest of it sounds a little dull. All right, moving on to something totally different. This is a documentary called Sisters with Transistors, and it profiles the women who pioneered electronic music. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Women were naturally drawn to electronic music. You didn't have to be accepted by any of the male-dominated resources. You could make something with electronics, and you can present music directly to your audience. And that gives you tremendous freedom.
All right, Bibbs, tell us about this one.
This is an incredibly interesting and immersive documentary that uses some new interview footage and a lot, like almost wall-to-wall archival footage of various women who were at the forefront of the electronic music revolution. And it's really, if you've only sort of casually follow music, a lot of this is going to be new to you, and I think you're going to be riveted. It's interesting to see how electronic music evolved from a concept, the idea that digital technology could be used to create music, and whether or not what it created could possibly be music by a conventional standard, and to see a wide variety of really fascinating women talk about how electronic music allowed them to turn the noises they could hear in their head, these incredible soundscapes and compositions that weren't even theoretically possible to turn into music before the invention of this technology. And to see that evolve from early experimentation through fascinating film scores. And I think it's really fascinating. I think it's, I actually look at electronic music a lot differently now than I did when I first watched it, because I hadn't really questioned electronic music as a concept before. And now I realize that, wow, there's a lot more possibilities here. And there's this really fascinating hidden history that doesn't get talked about enough. And it made me want to learn more.
And Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, I completely agree with Bibbs. I hadn't heard of any of these women who were featured in the documentary. So it feels like a historical corrective in a way to say, you know, electronic music seems like it's a very male-dominated, you know, subgenre of music. And it's actually like, no, these are the women who were really pioneering using Buchla synthesizers and computers and writing their own software and creating just, you know, they were kind of trying to completely break with the musical canon and, you know, write a whole new vocabulary of music. And a lot of these women, you know, they were forging their own path. They were trailblazers. They did not have role models, like not even in the sense of electronic music, but in female composers in general. So one of the women, Suzanne Ciani, who was a Buchla synthesizer pioneer, she was the first woman hired to compose a film score for The Incredible Shrinking Woman. And then it was 14 years before another woman was hired to compose a film score, you know, on her own for a feature film. And it's just really fascinating. And I love the way the director Lisa Rovner kind of melds the images, the archival footage, with the soundscapes and the compositions. And she sort of creates this very hallucinatory, like trippy audiovisual experience in the film. And she really ties in sort of like the environments that these women were coming from that sort of led to like the music that they were hearing, whether it was the Blitz in England during World War II, or airplanes taking off in Nice, or, you know, the Cold War, just like things that were all kind of coming together to create these sounds that these women had to sort of get out of their heads and into the world.
Yeah, I think the only woman who comes to mind in this field for me is Wendy Carlos, who did the scores for The Shining, Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, and they talk a little bit about her in this documentary, and they talk especially about her album Switched on Bach. And uh-huh. how that was this huge hit. But a lot of these women are doing things where they're saying, we don't even want to do Bach. We don't even want to do any of these male composers. We want to completely break with tradition.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating part of the documentary, because they talk about how what she did broke out electronic music and made a lot of people aware of it, but it also made it kind of regressive, because for a lot of people, electronic instrumentation became just another option to do the same kind of music we had done before, whereas a lot of, in fact, most of the women in the documentary were trying to do something that had literally never been done before.
All right. William Bibbiani is film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and the critically acclaimed network. Katie Walsh is film critic for the Tribune News Service and for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Mortal Kombat.
Coming up, a special feast for a special night. Evan Kleiman is here with some Oscar night food ideas. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, that means it's time to talk about food, and...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
Oh, and the Oscar goes to...
Evan Kleiman. Well, it should. Anyway. Hi, Evan.
As if. Hi, Madeline.
Well, it's all part of the theme, because you are going to give us some ideas for what we should serve if we have an Oscar party, and... Let's just say that we're not having any indoor parties unless everyone's fully vaccinated, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this year some people's friend groups might have enlarged a little bit because, you know, their inner circle is all vaxxed. And I think people are intrinsic to Oscar night, because I know for me it's the evening to let your inner mean girl out, and you need friends to make pointed remarks with at the screen.
Yes, you do, and you need some good sustenance. So,
yeah, and this
is fuel for that meanness.
Yes, you need fuel for that meanness, but I don't think this is one of those times where you need to pull up to a full meal. That somehow just doesn't seem right. So, I always think a grazing setup is really what you want.
And grazing means lots of different cheeses and olives, those kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely. I think a cheese board is your starting place. And these days, cheese boards can get super elaborate. And you can do it yourself, or you can just give yourself a break. Because there are people in this town who will just make unbelievably beautiful cheese boards for you that involve all different kinds of condiments.
Oh, okay. Well, give us a sampling.
So some of the just easy top of my mind cheese places are the Claremont Cheese Cave, Cheesemongers of Silver Lake, the Cheese Store of Beverly Hills, DTLA Cheese, Lady and Larder, Larchmont Village Wine, Spirits and Cheese. Now, the thing about all of these places is they go way beyond cheese. You know, if you ask them to put together a cheese board for you, it's going to be the cheese board, and it's going to have nuts and dried fruit and maybe some charcuterie if you ask for it. I always love to have a little bit of honeycomb on mine. I think it's beautiful and it's so much fun to eat. And also, all of these stores have a lot of condiments that you can just go insane. You can buy that guava marmalade you've been eyeing for a year, or you can also go crazy in the tinned fish aisle, maybe spend on some of that what usually seems to be a little pricey Spanish, you know, mussels in some kind of wonderful sauce. And to that end, there are these places that I call specialty food wonderlands that I just love to, it's like going to the library for me. If I have like an hour, and I'll go to like Epicurus Gourmet in the Valley or Monsieur Marcel in the Farmer's Market or Surface down on Washington. And I'll just walk up and down every single specialty food aisle. And you see things you've never seen before that catch your eye. And you can just put together an unbelievable spread.
I want to just get back to the honeycomb for just a moment, because I do love the look of a honeycomb on a cheese board. But actually putting it in my mouth with the wax, I'm a little...
Oh, so you were never a fan in Halloween of the little wax Pepsi bottles?
No.
Well, then for you, what you need is a beautiful little jar of some kind of fabulous honey. Drizzle it on also the fabulous bread you're going to buy or the great cracker you've always wanted that has maybe roasted hazelnuts and cranberries in it. I mean, this is like one of the greatest indoor picnic evenings of the year for me.
Oh, it sounds so good. I want to come to your house and eat your cheese board. But do you create like one big one for everyone or little ones for
one big
like
one,
individual ones?
One big one for everyone, and then have small plates for people to go and help themselves and get whatever they want. And it's good to have maybe double the amount of plates that you need because... for example, let's say somebody starts with some bread, some unbelievable butter, which we should talk about, and some tinned fish. They may not want to use that same plate to get their special Gouda with a little bit of honey. And then, of course, eventually you're going to have all the sweet stuff.
Right. Well, let's get to the butter first. Or does that count for the sweet stuff?
Oh, no, it doesn't count. Although if you have enough bread, butter, and honey... Yeah, that's pretty good.
Then you're set for life, really.
Yeah. So we're very lucky. We've become a very butter-intensive town. All of these specialty food wonderlands have an inventory of French and Vermont butters. I would say that Epicurus Gourmet, their selection is like going to the butter library. It's really overwhelmingly amazing.
I like butter, but I'm satisfied with a Kerrygold from Trader Joe's.
Well, that's fine. But
broaden my horizons?
Yes, you should. You should try a couple of the different small makers of beurre de burrat, which means these are butters that are kneaded by hand using these paddles. And the ones at Epicurus Gourmet come from a maker who specializes in adding things into the butter. So this might sound a little strange, but the most popular one, I believe, is the kelp butter. If you think of kelp as being this seafood umami, and it's just enough in the butter that it's like eating the most flavorful salted butter you've ever had in your life. But I think they have about usually between 5 and 10 different butters with different additions.
And what are you doing with this butter? You're just putting it on a cracker or bread and eating it plain?
To be really honest, sometimes I eat it like cheese.
Really?
P.S. I have a cardiology appointment this week.
And you're not baking with this butter.
No, not baking butter. These are eating butters, and they're great just a little bit on a cracker that you add the cheese on top, or butter and honey, or butter and sardines. A classic combination.
All right, let's get to the dessert platter after we're done with cheese and butter and all the rest of it.
Well, I think it depends. I think there's some people who like to go savory all night and some people who could do sweet all night. But I think you bring it out halfway. You don't need to wait to the very end because, once again, most of the sweets that I recommend that you add onto your spread will be of the finger kind, you know. And these stores all have wonderful sweet things, like Monsieur Marcel has a huge inventory of macarons, just a ton of different flavors. All these stores will usually have French caramels or locally made salted caramels. I mean, if you look deeply down the aisles of these Wonderlands, you will find things that you have walked by and said, oh, I'd like that, but you prevented yourself from reaching out. I think the Oscars is a night where you just say, you know, I'm going to get this.
Yeah, I'm going to celebrate myself.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a winner. I like that, Madeline.
All right. Well, that all sounds delicious, fun, festive. I'm excited. Check out the list of all the purveyors that Evan talked about. It's up at kcw.com. That's where you can get your specialty chocolate and everything else that she mentioned. Evan Kleinman, of course, is the host of KCW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturday mornings at 11.
You're a peach, Madeline. Thank you.
Thank you. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Have a fantastic weekend. Happy Oscar night. I'm Madeline Brand. See you Monday.